to 2 Corinthians chapter 6. I have at least three tasks that I want to accomplish this evening. Since, according to my reckoning, there are four sessions left, this one plus three for me, and then one for Kath, I've decided this evening I want to wrap up the essentials I want to share with you around the topic of the hazards of ministry and tie that into who we are as persons. Say something about self-care and the importance of self-care to your person. And then share with you some thoughts about the topic that I've tantalized you with, namely the dysfunctional church. I want to talk about how to set about healing a dysfunctional church. I'm making the assumption that everyone here has some measure of dysfunctionality to contend with every day of your life. And there are two or three. It's amazing how few essential principles there are that can make the difference and turn the corner, change the direction towards a healthier and more functional church. Then tomorrow morning, for both sessions, I want to address myself to the topic of depression. Several of you have come to me and say, when are we going to talk about depression? So I want to give both, because it needs a little more extended time to do justice to it, I would like to use both sessions tomorrow morning to address the topic of depression. And then tomorrow evening, burnout, and then Thursday morning, stress. So that's my agenda for the time that is left. Unfortunately, I don't have an outline for the topic of stress. I must apologize to Jeff. For some reason, I intended to include it, and I didn't. But I do have an excellent resource that I can point you to in my book, Adrenaline and Stress. But this evening, then, to conclude our discussion on the emotional hazards of the ministry and talk a little about self-care and how to set about healing the dysfunctional church, I want to read 2 Corinthians chapter 6, beginning with verse 3. Remember that the first six chapters of 2 Corinthians are the Apostle Paul's great theology of ministry chapters. Here he pours out his heart. He keeps referring to this ministry that we have, this ministry of reconciliation. And then he digresses for a moment to share his own hardships in ministry. And in sharing his own experience of hardships, he does so, I believe, to encourage us. Not to discourage us, but to encourage us. I often get accused by students, which is why I hate them, of sometimes presenting too pessimistic a view of what ministry is all about. But I'm not doing anything different to the Apostle Paul. I think we can only live with reality, folks. I don't think we can live with fantasy. And in the area of ministry, we've got to set fantasy aside. We've got to live with reality. And the reality is, this is tough work. And if you can't stand the heat, get out of the kitchen. Make room for those who can. But the Apostle Paul shares his own hardships, and he does so to encourage us. Because no matter how hard it is right now, dear pastor, no matter how tough it is right now, how tough the going is right now, you're in good company. You're in the Apostle Paul's company. And boy, was it tough for him. He says these words from verse 3. We put no stumbling block in anyone's path, so that our ministry will not be discredited. Rather, as servants of God, we commend ourselves in every way, in great endurance, in troubles, hardships and distresses, in beatings, imprisonments and riots,
in hard work, sleepless nights, and hunger. In purity, understanding, patience, and kindness. In the Holy Spirit, and in sincere love. In truthful speech, and in the power of God, with weapons of righteousness in the right hand and in the left, through glory and dishonor, bad report and good report, genuine yet regarded as unknown, dying and yet we live on, beaten and yet not killed, sorrowful, yet always rejoicing, poor, yet making many rich, having nothing, and yet possessing everything. That's the Apostle Paul. It's tough work. It's hard work. And look now, I don't know why it says six. I'm confused here. The numbering, something's wrong. Lecture 2, 1, 2, 3. I think it should be 4. You see where it says 6 problems arising from the minister? I think that should be 4, that number. I want to pick up at that point and say that in this tough going in ministry, there are certain contributions we make towards the problem. We bring to the work of ministry our own personality characteristics, first of all, and secondly, our own present mental state. We bring to ministry a certain degree that a contribution to the problem. And I think that we need to do a better job for ourselves in owning what that contribution is. We bring our own quirks. We bring our own neurotic behaviors. We bring our own unfinished business. And that's really what I wanted to take a moment to say something about. Our own unfinished business. We bring it to ministry. And there's a sense in which we try to work out this unfinished business. We try to work it out in the context of ministry, hoping somehow that as we minister to others, that we'll solve our own difficulties and problems. It's not unlike what we see in clinical psychology or psychiatry. We constantly, my years as dean, having to select students, we turn away 3 out of every 4 who apply to our program. We can only take a certain number, and you know, you how do you choose? And the first thing you do is eliminate people who want to go into my profession to solve their own personal problem. That's not why you become a psychologist or a psychiatrist, to solve your own problems. But I wonder how often people go into ministry to solve perhaps their own spiritual problems or difficulties. So one must have a sense of one's own unfinished business. Now, I wrote a book some years ago. In fact, I'm busy revising it while I'm on the strip. I'm busy working on it and revising it because the publisher wants to put it out again. It's a book called Children and Divorce. My parents divorced when I was 12. And it wasn't until I was in my early 30s, beginning to take shape as a clinical psychologist, that I began to realize how much of the issues I was struggling with in my early 30s could be traced back to the impact of my parents' divorce on my life. Tomorrow morning I'm going to talk about depression. And it wasn't until in my 30s that I realized that from age 12, when my parents divorced, until well into my 20s, I was in a significant depression. Never knew it. Unfinished business. Anger towards my father for the breakup of the marriage, for the way he treated my mother. Unfinished business. And so here I am in my 30s, having difficulty with authority figures. I'd had my experience with the boss from hell.
But a lot of that experience arose out of my own difficulty with authority figures that in turn could be traced back to the problems I had with my own father.
And then I discovered also in my early 30s that I was on a search, I was on a quest. I was looking for a substitute father. I was looking for an older male, someone who would take me under his wing, someone who would mentor me. Someone who would be my father for me. You know, one of the things you have to do with that unfinished business stuff is there's no way you can replace your father. You better go do your crying, go into your depression, go do your grieving, go get it over with, because there is no way you can replace that which is missing from an earlier part of your life. Unfinished business.
I wrote that book about how we could help our children experience divorce in a more healthy way. Save all that damage. You know, if someone had only paid a little attention to me as a 12-year-old kid, I could have avoided a lot of pain and hardship in my life. And later on, well into my 50s now, I wrote another book. It's now called, it's been reissued, called Growing Up Divorced.
When I began to now examine my life in my 50s, and realizing that still in my 50s, I have all this unfinished stuff. Yeah, I'm trying to work with a patient and deal with some critical issues. And all the stuff keeps intruding. And so I suggest to you that we bring to ministry a lot of unfinished business. Grieving, perhaps, that hasn't been done properly. Difficulties that we have experienced. And this then predisposes us to future problems, you see. Now, what sorts of problems do we have to contend with? The first one there that I've put on, the only one we'll probably have time to deal with, is the topic of depression. Surviving ministry is a matter of surviving depression. Ministry is fraught with opportunities for depression. And so unless you know how to deal with it, you know, there's no way you can manage it and do it and thrive on it. And the problem is that 90% of the people who have significant depression don't know it, are unable to acknowledge it. Unfinished business. Then under point five, there are some problem situations that arise in ministry. You see, I'm saying that we bring to ministry certain unfinished business baggage. And we need to do a better job. Oh, I wish we could in our seminary help our young people, those going into ministry, we could just help them get in touch with all that baggage. Come on now. Let's lay it out. Let's sort of get it out there so we can look at it. Let's decide what we're going to do about it. But now, there's the other side, and this is the side I want to turn attention to. The problems, the situations that arise in ministry. The church situations. So just hold that for a moment, and then I want to make that the major part of my presentation tonight, but I do want to just wrap up under point six. The marriage, Kath and I will share some stuff tomorrow afternoon on marriage. And the other points there will become obvious when I talk about the dysfunctional church. But go to point six, because I want to emphasize right now, before we close out this topic, the importance of self-care. The importance of taking care of yourself. Why do we have problems with self-care? Come on, you've all been too quiet today. I need some interaction. Shout it out. Why do we have problems with self-care? There's nothing wrong with me, mate. Sure, we won't acknowledge that there's anything that needs care. What other reason? Excuse me? Selfish. It has a selfish connotation, doesn't it? It's got that word self in it. If it's got the word self in it, then it's got to be bad. We have indoctrinated ourselves with anything that's got self in it's got to be bad. Self-care must be bad. It's selfish. Self-centered. Self-serving. Any other reason? It takes time. That's a good point. My word, the self-care stuff takes time. And it takes time away from ministry, right? There was this guy who was taking a walk down a country road one day, and he passed a farmer who was standing in his backyard with a log saw and was sawing a log with this long log saw. Sawing it. And the man walked by and noticed this and went down the road for his walk, and an hour later came back, and there was the farmer still sawing away with that same saw, hadn't made much progress. So this stranger, city slicker, thought for a moment and thought, well, I'm going to go up and give this farmer some advice. Says to the farmer, I noticed, sir, that you've been sawing away at that same log all this time. Why don't you sharpen the saw? And the farmer looked up at him and said, ain't got time. I've got a saw. Ain't got time. You know, back to sawing. There's a sense in which self-care is sharpening the saw. Self-care is sharpening the saw. Self-care is not an option. Not in ministry. It is mandatory. Self-care, the care of the self, is the essential tool by which we renew the self. Without self-care, you die prematurely. You die prematurely. We had a provost at Fuller, my immediate boss, wonderful guy, Baptist, by the name of Glenn Barker. Just a deeply, deeply committed spiritual person. And we would have our meetings usually over breakfast. Have a meeting once a month with him as my immediate supervisor and talk about things. And I'd get on his case and I'd say, Glenn, you know, I'm really worried about you. I just think, what's your blood pressure like? You know, how are you eating? Are you getting a good sleep? Are you resting? Because he always gave me the impression of sort of living on the edge. He worked late into the night. You know, you leave the campus and you look in the parking garage and his car's still there, late at night. I'll never forget, it was a Friday morning, I had this breakfast meeting with Glenn, and I had determined that I was going to come down hard on him. Glenn, I said to him at that breakfast meeting, your stress is out of control. The way you go about it is not glorifying to God. You're burning the candles at both ends. And I challenged him to balance his life, to be a little more self-caring. Not so that he can live and preserve himself for eternity unscathed. You know, this is not a matter of sort of putting yourself on mothballs and preserving yourself so that when, you know, when life is finally over, you go to heaven and say, look, I've hardly used this thing. You know, it's still pretty new. Like the clothing, you go to some of these used clothing stores and some of their clothing looks pretty good. Never been worn at all. So it's not a matter of preserving yourself so you can go to heaven with this unused body and mind. But that you live a long and effective life. And more importantly, that self-care is all about efficiency. How can I be maximally efficient for God? And there's only one way, and you have to learn how to take care of yourself. And so I've given Glenn all this stuff, this speech, and I said, no, Glenn, I need you to participate with me. We've got to do some stress management in your life. Now I want to help you. He thanked me, and that afternoon, about 3 o'clock in the afternoon, we got a phone call at home. Friday afternoons I usually split. I get out of the campus. I get away as far as I can from those students. And about as much as I can take it, you know, until Friday midday. And I got this phone call, and it was a person said, I'm a friend of Glenn Barker's. We're down on the tennis court. Glenn had agreed to play some tennis with us right now, but he's collapsed. He's on the tennis court. He's having a heart attack. We're giving him CPR, trying to revive him. We're waiting for the ambulance. Just thought we'd let you know, let some of the other folk know also that Glenn is having this heart attack. Said, I'll meet you down at the emergency room. I jumped in my car, rushed down to the emergency room. First person there, paced up and down. No sign of Glenn. No one had come in yet. Shortly later, one or two other faculty who had also got the news arrived, and we stood around waiting. And then finally, the ambulance came, and they wheeled in the gurney. And they wheeled. I stood there right at the entrance as they pulled him in, and the gurney stopped right in front of me. And I looked down. And I looked at Glenn, and his face was blue, stone cold, dead. And I wanted to take my fists and pound them on his chest and say, what a waste. What a waste. How much more could you have done for God's kingdom? And that, you see, that's the issue here. Are you burning out? By that I mean, I use in a positive connotation. Are you? It's a controlled giving up of myself. I have the handle on my life. I determine how fast I die. We know enough about stress now. We know enough about stress that we know exactly how we can accelerate our demise or how we can slow it down. You know, if life is so painful for you that you want to get it over with as quickly as possible, please come and see me afterwards. I'll write the prescription for you. You can get out of your misery pretty quickly. All you've got to do is stop being self-caring. All you've got to do is burn the candle at both ends. Self-care is a spiritual discipline. Being renewed day by day, the Apostle Paul writes in 2 Corinthians chapter 4, being renewed day by day, self-care is essential. The great Barnhouse, who was a Presbyterian preacher of the early part of the century, who in fact started pioneering radio broadcasting for the gospel, 1927, he started broadcasting the gospel on radio. The first radio evangelist. Before Charles E. Fuller, the radio evangelist for which Fuller Seminary is named. Any of you ever listened to Charles E. Fuller on the radio? Wow, that's great. What was his favorite? What was the chorus that they sang? That's right, just a little test. It was Heavenly Sunshine. Heavenly Sunshine. His wife, Honey. I was a little kid sitting next to my grandfather's knee in a little country town of South Africa, tuning shortwave radio to Lorenzo Marx. 9 o'clock every night, you've got Rudy Atwood at the piano and that wonderful choir from Long Beach Auditorium and the Charles E. Fuller half-hour program. Charles E. Fuller was one of the early radio evangelists, but Barnhouse was before Charles E. Fuller. Founder and editor of Eternity magazine. A profoundly influential evangelist. But you know what he said one day? He said these words. He said that if I knew that Jesus was coming back in 3 years, if I knew absolutely for certain that Jesus was coming back in 3 years, he said, I would take 2 years for preparation. And in 1 year I'd go and preach the gospel. My word. What would you do?
If I announce right now, categorically, absolutely, I have it. Trust me, Jesus is coming back in 3 years. Up, out the back door. Down into Brisbane, down into Sydney. Go back to Africa, many of you. Or wherever else you were missionaries. Got to go preach the gospel. Jesus is coming back. Barnhouse says, I would take 2 years for preparation. 1 year I'd go and preach. The profundity of that perception staggers, blows my mind. But what he is saying, you see, is that there's more to Jesus coming back than rushing out and doing whatever we can to appease our guilt and make up for everything that we have failed to do. And there's a lot more to it than that. There's preparation. There's personal preparation. There is spiritual preparation. So caring for oneself is not a luxury, but a necessity. No time spent in the wilderness is wasted. But we resist the idea, self-care. We resist it because we're ignorant. We resist it because we're stupid. We're misinformed. We resist it because we think it's unspiritual. We resist it because we feel guilty whenever we take care of ourselves. We resist it because we ask, what will others think? Our grandstand's too full of people. They won't let us rest. Run around. There's the ball. Go chase the ball. Do something. Our grandstand is shouting at us, you see. So we have to change our attitude to self-care, and let me just go through a few steps. First thing you've got to do is correct your misunderstanding of the notion of self. We get into a lot of difficulty if we misunderstand the notion of self. Part of the problem is that we have one word and we use it with different meanings. I wrote a book and I commend it to you. It's called Me, Myself, and I. Because I got fed up with the way we evangelicals confuse these words. And I think Satan just feeds the confusion. We think, well, you know, we're called to deny ourselves, right? But then we realize if you're raising teenagers, you stop and think every now and again, well, am I doing what I should be doing to help them with their self-esteem? So here we have self-denial, and here we have self-esteem. It's the same word, self, but think about it for a moment. It means two different things. The self that we deny is not the same self that we have to take care of when I say you must be self-caring. It's the same word, but it's two different things. A pastor's wife once said to me, I tried to die to self, and myself nearly died. She was right on target. She was using the same word, but with different meanings. I died to self. I die to selfish ambition. I die to my agenda for my life. Yes, I die to all of that. But for myself to die, I've got to lie down in the box and let him put the lid on it and pack me away forever. Because I am a self. When the Apostle Paul says that we do not lose heart, though outwardly we are wasting away, yet inwardly we are being renewed by day. He is saying that there has to be a process of renewal going on within myself. It's not with anything else. There's nothing else. There is nothing else in me to be renewed except myself. How can we talk about the self
the essence of who I am as a being dying, because the only way that can die is when you put me in the box. The self that must die, the self that we deny, all that self refers to a very specific aspect of who I am as a self. And I ignore self-care to my detriment. I can tell you exactly what happens when you don't take care of yourself. You're not as efficient as you can be. Stress symptoms will overwhelm you. And your life will be short. It will be short. Now, in essence, basically, we all need to have a strategic plan for the care of ourselves. We need to have a strategic plan for the care of our spiritual selves, because myself is a spiritual self as well. I need to have a strategic plan for my spiritual growth. If you're not growing spiritually, you're dying. I also need it for my physical as well as my personal, a strategic plan. And it's essentially a plan that balances my life. And I would challenge you, I would challenge you in the weeks that lie ahead to sit down, take off a few hours, and sit down with yourself. See, part of the problem why the self-care stuff frightens us, because we've got to spend that time with ourselves. And we're our own worst enemies. The worst relationships many of us have is the relationship we have with ourselves. We're not in very good speaking terms with ourselves. But sit down and prayerfully consider every facet of your life. What are you doing to yourself physically? Evangelicals have a very low view of the body. That's not biblical. Scripture tells us that God will hold us accountable for how we treat our bodies. It's the temple of the Holy Spirit. We treat it like it's this piece of clay, this earthenware jar. Scripture, we don't understand the context. Come with me to Africa. I think that's where you'll get the context. When it says, when it talks about we have this treasure in jars of clay, you've got to understand that the people who use clay jars treat them very, very gently and kindly. You see them lined up, Hessian covered, kept moist. If you've got to walk eight miles to get water with a clay pot on your head, you don't mistreat that clay pot. It's stupid if you do. Things are going to disintegrate on your head. You're going to have to get another pot and walk another 8 miles to go and get water. That's the image of the clay pot. A strategic plan. I love to quote Rick Warren again, who is very strong on this self-care thing. He has a thing he calls SHAPE, that many of you have heard about. SHAPE, you know. S, what are my spiritual gifts? What's my strategic plan for developing my gifts? H, what is my heart? What's my passion? What's my plan for developing that? A, abilities. P, what's my personality? Do you have a plan for fixing that personality of yours? Should have. E, my experiences. What do my experiences contribute? A strategic plan. And it's a plan that balances your life. That balances your life. And see what a difference it makes to your effectiveness. In the outline I have developed a trustworthy support system. I'll say more about that when we talk about burnout and stress management, and all of that comes later tomorrow. But turn with me now. You don't have it, so you can't turn with me because you don't have an outline, but I want to turn your attention now to some thoughts around the topic of the dysfunctional church and some of the things that need to be done in this regard. The whole notion of a dysfunctional church is something that has, I'm going to take my jacket off, something that has come about in recent years. Only fairly recently have we begun to realize something that is now so very obvious. And that is that the church body, the body of believers, functions very much like a family. And in fact, a lot of family dynamics can help us understand how the church functions as a family. And there are really three families in the pastor's life. Three families. There is your own family and its dysfunction, how healthy it is. Then there are the families of the family members, of which you are ex officio a member. It fascinates me how this comes about, that you are ex officio a member of everyone else's family, right? You come to the hospital, go to the hospital room, hospital bed, and the family's around, the loved one who is ill or dying or whatever, and you step in and the family parts and says, join the circle, the inner circle. So you remember, you're an ex officio member of every family. But then there's a third family, and that is the congregation as a whole. And together these three families form an extended family field, we call it, and dysfunction can operate in any one of them, or all of them. The more dysfunctional the families of the church, the more likely that dysfunction is going to be carried over, and the people in the church as a family are going to operate on the same principles they do in their own private family lives. Now, what are the symptoms of a dysfunctional church? Let me just run down with you. Let's do a little diagnostic exercise. And let me go down with you on some of the critical symptoms of a dysfunctional system. Because we really are thinking system here. Now, you must remember that system thinking is fascinating in that it does not see any one person or entity as the problem. We in the Western world, I mean, I know, I got these parents who come to me and say, I got this 14-year-old teenager. He's giving us problems. He's causing us headaches. He's a real pain in the butt. Fix him. We'll be back in an hour. And off they go. And they expect you, you know, to spend an hour with their kid and come back an hour later and fetch him and then bring them the next week. Now, that's our Western way of thinking. Somebody's sick, you go to the doctor. The person, you know, goes to the doctor and you fix it. Now, that's not African. In Africa, what happens is if a member of the family gets sick, what happens is that the whole family packs up and makes the 12-mile trek to the missionary clinic and sets up camp just outside the clinic and says, what did they say? The child is here, the child is sick. No, no, no. We are here. The child is sick. Africans have this understanding of that when there is something sick, that the system is also part of that sickness. And that's how system theory operates. And this is important because, you see, when you have a problem group or a problem person acting out in a church, it is... often that person is not the key problem. It's only a symptom of the system's problem. But what are the symptoms? Let me just go through some. First of all, top of the list for me for a dysfunctional church is that there are power struggles. Power struggles. The smaller the church, the fewer involved, but always a power struggle. Usually the power struggle is someone who contributes heavily to the finances of the church. That gives them the erroneous belief that they then call the shots. If I had my way, you know, every person who made a significant donation, I would have them sign a release form. I hereby release this money, this donation, to be used however it is seen fit by the managing the body of the church. There are a lot of people who rule the roost because they pay the bills, you see. But power struggles. Power-hungry people struggling for power. And the more the pastor sits on the fence, the less the pastor is differentiated, the more others struggle to get power. So power struggles. Secondly, in a dysfunctional system, there's a high level of sabotage. People sabotage things. Oh, they go to the meeting and they all vote unanimously in favor of whatever it is they're voting for. And the very next day, they're sabotaging it. Sabotage is a very common symptom in a dysfunctional system. Because sabotage, in a sense, gives people, negative people, power. They know that they won't get their way. They know they can't convince others to do things their way. But so what they will do is, well, they'll sabotage it. They'll see that it doesn't work. So a lot of sabotage. Pastors have to know how to deal with sabotage. They know how to deal with it. And the most effective way to deal with sabotage is to call it for what it's worth. To call it for what it's worth. Bring it out into the open. And expose it for what it is worth. A third symptom of a dysfunctional system is that there is excessive secrecy. This is one that also fascinates me. You move into a group, institution, whatever, and the higher the number of secrets kept, the greater is the sickness of that group. Families with secrets are sick families. The more secrets in the family, the more things hidden in the closet, the more things that the kids are not supposed to know about the parents, about Uncle Joe, or about whatever, the more secrets, the more dysfunctional. Excuse me, my reference to Africa again. In Africa, we have an expression. We say we walk in the light. That, you know what that means? Everything above board. Everything above board. Nothing hidden. No hidden agendas. Nothing under the table. Everything above board. We went through an interesting period at Fuller Seminary 5 or 6 years ago. After Glenn Barker, the provost I mentioned, had died of that heart attack, we were without a provost for a year and a half. And finally, we appointed a new provost. He was a brilliant man. He came to us from the University of California, where he was a professor of surgery, gastrointestinal surgery. He was a missionary for many years on the mission field, and he was getting near retirement. And we needed an experienced academic administrator for this position, and he offered his services to serve as provost for us for at least until he reached retirement age. And he'd been on our board of trustees, a wonderfully wonderful Christian man, and we welcomed him on board as our new provost, the three deans. But at our first cabinet meeting, the provost and the three deans, Larry said to each of us, he said, you know, my observation of the way you've operated here for several years now is that you have lots of secrets. I want you to know, I tolerate no secrets. And what he was referring to was that each of the deans had had their private deals worked out with Glenn, the previous provost. We'd had our private deal. I'd needed extra money to pay faculty salaries because psychologists don't come as cheaply as missiologists or as theologians. And I needed to tweak their benefits a little bit, and Larry and Glenn had worked out a private deal with me, but it was sort of unwritten law that the other deans were not to find out, because if they did, all sorts of trouble would ensue. And then at budget time, we negotiated, and I got a few special deals going. And after a while, I had all this secret stuff that had been negotiated. And so when Larry said, I want everything out on the table, I said at the meeting, I said, all hell's going to break loose. All hell's going to break loose. But then I began to think, if I had all those private deals worked out with Glenn, then surely the other deans had their own private deals. And the dean of the School of World Mission, mission always seems to have a special soft touch for somebody. And, maybe they were getting a better deal all along. And suddenly my level of distrust, I realized that for some time now, we didn't trust each other. And that's the problem with secrets, is that distrust level goes up. In fact, next week, Larry said, you bring all your budgets, you bring all your letters of agreement with Glenn. I want everything out on the table. We're going to spend the whole day sorting this out. And we just put it out, and I just sort of shrieked, you know. And through to my prediction, all hell broke loose, you know. Everyone was angry with another. But after about an hour, it subsided, and a new level of trust emerged between us as a team. And from that moment onwards, no secret. If I had a special need in the School of Psychology, and I had to appeal for some special resources to be directed my way, it had to be talked about by all of us and agreed to by all of us. And suddenly this distrust was gone. Now, an unhealthy system, you see, has lots of secrets. And especially pastors, you know, Joe Soap comes to you, Pastor, I want to tell you something, but I don't want you to tell them that I'm telling you this, that the women's group over there, they're not very happy with the way you're managing things. But don't tell them I said so. And the other pastor is standing there thinking, now what do you do with that? What do you do with that? If you go and act on it, this person's going to be furious with you. And so secrets immobilize you. Secrets are secrets because they always put someone else at a disadvantage. They drive wedges between people. Pastor, I want to tell you something, but I don't want them to know. I just want you, this is just something between you and I. It forms false alliances. So you think, the person who's sharing the secret thinks that you and that person have a special relationship because you share a secret. But someone else is always at a disadvantage. Now the difference between a secret and a confidence is enormous. And the difference, and one has to keep confidences all the time. But the difference between a secret and a confidence lies essentially in the motive. In the motive. The secret is designed to alienate someone else. A confidence is motivated by love and a desire to bring healing. And so the exact same thing in one circumstance is a secret, in another circumstance is a confidence. When I'm working with a patient, or perhaps you as a pastor counseling someone who perhaps for whatever reason there is something that has happened in their life that is not well pleasing or desirable, and they share a confidence with us, and we keep that confidence. A confidence is not a secret. But when someone says to you, Pastor, I'm going to share this with you, but I don't want you to tell my husband, raise your hands right there and then and say, I can't receive it. That would be a secret. You can have no secret. If you want to share something with me in confidence, then I suggest you go ahead and do it. And trust me. Trust me. But no conditions. A condition is a secret. It's a secret. Now the other thing I want to say about secrets, not only is it high percentage, a lot of secrets is typical of a dysfunctional system, but that you must, it's not your business to break secrets. Boy, do we have a problem with our students trying to teach them this. It's not your job to break secrets. Not your job. Your job is to empower people to tell the truth, first of all. Secondly, and to prepare people to receive the truth. And there are times when maybe for a trillion years, one will never ever divulge or have anyone else divulge it. And there are times when a wife must keep something as a confidence with you. Because the moment hasn't arrived when it can achieve a healing function. It brings healing. It brings healing. A pastor and his wife were seeing me 2 or 3 years ago, and the wife was really having problems. She was 49 years and 11 months old,
I know that because she was morbidly fearful of turning 50.
And so she had tried to recapture her youth and had begun to dress like her 17-year-old daughter.
In fact, was stealing her daughter's clothes and dressing in her daughter's teenage clothes.
But trying to recapture her youth. And the husband, a prominent pastor in a city next over from us, was going berserk. You know, what are people thinking about my wife acting like a teenager and dressing like that? And so they were in therapy with me. We were trying to resolve her midlife crisis. And one day I went out to the waiting room to invite them in, and as I approached, she stood up first ahead of her husband and says, "I need to talk to you alone today first." I turned to him and said, "Is that okay?" He said, "Yeah, sure, I don't know what it is, but by all means, let my wife have a few moments with you alone first." And I invited her in, she sat down and she said to me, I have something terrible to report, and that is that my 17-year-old daughter is pregnant. She hardly knows the boy who may go pregnant, but she wants to keep the baby, and she certainly doesn't want to marry this boy. The moment my husband finds out, he's going to drop dead because he has a heart problem. Would you please tell him?" And, basically she was saying that unless you tell him, it'll have to remain a secret. And I said to her, "How long is this going to remain a secret, right? How long is this going to be a secret?" So we processed it a little bit, and I said to her, "No, it's not my job." The very important rule in secrets is put the responsibility back where it belongs. And so I put the responsibility back where it belongs. I said to her, "No, it's not my responsibility to tell your husband. And furthermore," I said, "it's not your responsibility either. Put the responsibility back where it belongs. Whose responsibility is it to tell the father that she's pregnant? The daughter's responsibility. You go home today, you tell your daughter, 'Honey, it's your responsibility, you have to tell your father that you're pregnant.'" She said, "But my daughter hasn't talked to her father for 3 years. He walks into the room, she walks out. They hate each other's guts. She doesn't talk to her father." I said, "So? What's the problem? Put the responsibility back where it belongs. Honey, if you don't tell your father you're pregnant, then he doesn't get told. Your responsibility." She went home that day. Invited the husband in, spent the rest of the session together. Never once did we mention the daughter's pregnancy. When she went home that afternoon, sat down with her daughter and said, "Honey, I thought it through. It's not my responsibility to tell your father. It's your responsibility." The daughter was asking the mother to tell the father because she wasn't talking to her father. "It's your responsibility. You must tell your father. And if you don't want to tell him, then so be it. That's where it rests." She said, "Okay." So much for that problem. Gets up, walks down the passage, knocks on his study door. He had his study at home. Goes in, and we didn't know exactly what happened inside. But the next day, the next session, I saw the mother. She shared with me the fact that the daughter had gone in. Father was taken aback when she came through the door. "What's this? She hasn't talked to me. You know, 3 years we haven't talked, and she's coming into my study." And he was taken aback for a moment. She sat down and said, "Dad, I've got some bad news to share with you." And the father, stunned, said, "Well, what is it?" She said, "I'm pregnant. I hardly know the boy. I don't want to marry him, but I want to have the baby." And the father got up, walked around the desk to the other side, and just took her in his arms. Just took her, held her, said, "It'll be okay. We'll make it work. We'll find a way for it to work." And that relationship was healed because the right thing was done, you see. That's the thing about this healthy stuff. That when you do the right thing, it brings healing. It restores relationships. The unhealthy stuff is what divides and brings down. Oh, that little boy now is
That little kid, what is he? 2-3 years of age, the apple of his grandfather's eye. The mother's midlife crisis was resolved that very next week. She came dressed like a sensible 49-year-old, 11 months, and she sat down and she said, I'm going to be a grandmother. I got things I've got to do to get ready. Suddenly, she embraced her reality, you see. That's health. That's wholeness. Symptoms of a dysfunctional workplace, quickly as we move to close. The power is in the hands of a few. Emotions are avoided. This is also an interesting sign of a dysfunctional workplace. Can't handle emotions. You've probably noticed I cry quite easily. That shocks a lot of Australian men, believe it or not. But a dysfunctional system can't handle emotions. Anyone gets angry, well, look, peace at all costs. Can't tolerate troublemakers. Peace, just keep the peace. You see, that doesn't take any courage, it doesn't take any guts to deal with that. A dysfunctional system violates boundaries. People don't know their boundaries. They don't know their boundaries in terms of responsibilities that are assigned to them, and so they're doing things that should be done by somebody else. You know, Mrs. Jones always arranges the flowers on a Saturday afternoon. He has Mrs. Smith coming in on a Saturday afternoon, and she's got a whole bunch of flowers, and she wants to do the flowers. No sense of boundaries. Often, high incidence of boundary violation occurs in a system where there isn't clear leadership, isn't clear direction, roles are not being clarified, people don't know when their responsibility begins and where the responsibility ends. And often this role confusion exists because there isn't a healthy assertiveness. Not able to speak up and do so without anger. The problem of assertiveness, I wish we had time to talk about that. Most people, most of us, can only be assertive when we get angry. Then we can stand up for our rights. The anger gives us the courage to do it. That's not Christian assertiveness at all. If you hurt someone when you try to be assertive, you're not doing it right. Christian assertiveness always heals. Always heals. Now, my wife won't mind if I tell this story, but her very first visit, I'd been to Australia several times before she finally joined me on a trip, and we were on this trip, and a very well-known Australian was planning it for us, and we were going from place to place doing seminars and stuff. And one afternoon we were free, and he suggested we go out for a bit of a drive and do some sightseeing. We were off oohing and aahing at, I don't know, koala bears or those things that hop around, whatever. And we ended up in a little tea room. My wife loves her tea. So we stopped at this tea shop, this restaurant to have tea. We ordered 3 teas, and the waitress brought 3 cups and 3 saucers and put them down in front of us. And my wife picked up her cup, the waitress walked away, and she looked at it, and there, around the rim of the cup, was a distinct lipstick mark. The washing machine had not erased that lipstick. And she just politely commented, wow, look, I've got lipstick on this cup. I'll just call the waitress and have her take care of it. Now, the friend, our Australian host, quickly jumped in and said, oh, it's all right. Why don't you take my cup? He was quite willing to exchange cup and turn the cup around and drink from the other side of the cup. And you know, his reaction was a natural one. He wanted to avoid embarrassing the waitress. And Kath said, no. The waitress will understand. So she called the waitress over, and she said in her own, you know, non-aggressive but assertive way, I know you wouldn't want me to drink out of a cup with a lipstick mark on it. It obviously didn't. Something happened back there. And very politely, basically said to the waitress, I know you would want me. You would want me to tell you this. And she said, of course I would. And went off and got a clean cup and brought it back. And the next thing, she was having a conversation with Kat. There in the restaurant, they became the greatest of friends. And this hostess sat back, marveling. You know, a Christian assertiveness heals. It builds bridges. It's the way of honesty. It's the way of love. In a dysfunctional system, defensiveness is high. So you can't ever find fault with anything. You can't ever criticize. You can't even suggest improvement. Because all the defenses are high. All the defenses go up. Now, how does one, in closing, let me just give you a few quick suggestions on how we bring healing to a dysfunctional system. First of all, top of the list, you must give leadership to the system and not to individuals. Underline that. Problem people are like those foxes in the fox hunt that will get you chasing after them and spending all your energy problem solving and running interference for these problem people. And if you're not careful, you use up all your energy chasing after all the problem people, and the system hangs there limp, without direction or anything. You give leadership to the system. Don't be distracted by the petty, the troublemakers and the problem people. You've got to stay focused on the essentials. On the essentials. So you give leadership to the system, not individuals. When you give leadership to the system will know how to deal with problem individuals. First point. Second point, that to bring healing to a dysfunctional system, you have got to stay in touch with all the groups. One of the biggest mistakes a pastor can make in a dysfunctional church is to say, well, that group there, whatever it is, the youth group, or this group, or the men's group, or whatever group, that's the problem group. I will just ignore them. I will avoid them. The biggest mistake you can make. Often, it's the wheel that is squeaking the loudest that is wanting your attention. The group, not individuals, the group. And so you have to stay in touch with all groups. A good leader is able to stay in touch with all groups, no matter how difficult it may seem. Because when you stay in touch with all groups, you know what's going on, and now you can give leadership to the system. The third principle in healing a dysfunctional system is that you must yourself be fully and completely differentiated. I used this term, I think, this morning or yesterday. Must be differentiated. You have got to know where you stand. You must have a well-developed idea of where you stand on every possible issue that affects the church. I mean, are you going to expand part of the church building? You need to know where you stand on that matter. Are you going to adopt some new policies for something or other? You need to be clear yourself. Do your homework ahead of time. And the more dysfunctional the church, the more you better do your homework ahead of time. Because then you won't be taken by surprise. But your position must be non-reactive, non-anxious. And I want to close just with some thoughts around this theme of maintaining a non-anxious presence. A non-anxious presence. Anxiety is contagious. It's contagious. And if the leader is anxious, the whole system gets anxious. Someone was telling me just the other day, using a war analogy, that officers in wartime are taught that they must never run. If the officer runs, the men will panic because something's, you know, there's trouble. So there's a good analogy for this in ministry, that if the pastor is anxious, then something's wrong and everybody gets anxious. And maintain a non-anxious presence. Well, we've come to the end of our time this evening, and I want to close. The story I told you about Joshua ben Levi, the rabbi, on his quest for the Messiah, I just want to close with a few thoughts about that. That story didn't end where I left it, with the rabbi standing there watching the wounded healer bind his wounds. But the legend goes on. The legend goes on to say that the rabbi finally gets up the courage to move forward toward the Messiah and addresses the Messiah, saying, "Peace to you, Master and Teacher." And the Messiah says, "Peace to you, my son of Levi." And then the rabbi asks, "Messiah, when are you coming?" And the Messiah answers, one word, "Today, today." The rabbi turns. Steven Spielberg again. Face, low angle, looking up because his head is bowed. Brow is furrowed, he's worried, he's upset, he's angry. He turns away from the Messiah, and with his stick he knocks and clears away to get away from this crowd. The stench is more than he can bear. And he makes his way slowly up the hill again, past Elijah's cave. Elijah is still sitting there. Elijah sees him come, and as he approaches, Elijah says, "Rabbi, did you find the Messiah?" Rabbi says, "Yes, I found the Messiah." "Rabbi, did you ask him when he was coming?" And the rabbi says, "Yes, I asked him when he was coming." "Well, what did he say?" The rabbi says these words, "He lied. He lied." "What do you mean, Rabbi?" "He lied. He said, today, today I am coming. He has not come." And the rabbi continues his walk. Elijah looks after the rabbi and says these words, "You fool, you fool. You weren't listening. You didn't understand. When he said today, he was quoting from the Psalms. This is what he told you. Today, if you will listen to his voice, he has come." Today. Henry Nouwen uses that closing of the story to say that, you know, that healing has come for all of us. It's here, it's there, it's today. Today is the day. See, a lot of us are probably sitting there saying, "Well, you know, next year when I take my vacation, yeah, I think I might give a little thought to this self-care stuff. I will learn how to sleep a little better. I learn how to relax a little better. I learn how to take some time off. I learn how to set limits on my time." But today, now, it's the time. Now is the time. Not next month or next year, but now. And oh, that today we would listen to his voice.